January 2022, whole new year. And in fact, this is Ryan and I's 6-year anniversary of the podcast and Annals of Emergency Medicine's 50-year anniversary.
Yep, back in 1972, the first issue of the Journal of the American College of Emergency Physicians rolled off the presses. They have not had a podcast for these last 50 years, but if you read the print copy of the Annals of Emergency Medicine this month, you'll get to read a little editorial by Michael Callahan and some news and perspective pieces. And the whole year will be dedicated to sort of looking back at the history of the specialty of emergency medicine in the United States and some highlights from the journal that you may have missed if you were not subscribing back in 1972.
Yeah, I always like the look backs, you know, back in my day, emergency medicine was, and those are always a lot of fun. So,
oh, yeah. Like back when they would, like, it was thought to be unethical to do like randomized controlled trials of nitroglycerin for acute heart failure and pulmonary edema. And it was like, morphine is the standard of care. You cannot give anything but morphine. I love those old textbooks.
Right. And before, you know, before they had RSI medications for intubation, so using whatever they could find in the back closet.
Yeah, there you go. Good times. Yep. So I'm sure that if you look through the journal for the next year, you'll get to step back in time to see what your colleagues used to do back in the day. I'm sure pretty interesting for some of the folks who are just starting out in emergency medicine these days.
Yeah. So why don't we jump from the past to the present? And Ryan, why don't you tell us about what's going on in emergency medicine practice these days?
Oh, yes. Let's jump from the beautiful past to the grim future. So this first article that's in the journal this month is called Group Practice Size Consolidation in Emergency Medicine. The lead author here is Jordan Pollack, and they're at the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. This is the one in Arizona. And this is one of those, what's the practice landscape in United States medicine looking like with an eye to what's, well, really abundantly obvious to anybody who's been to an ACEP conference recently or tried looking for work. When the introduction to the article cites the work of, quote unquote, the rape of emergency medicine, you probably have some idea of the general bias. Regardless, looking at the Physician Compare database from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, these authors determined emergency physician billing affiliations and group taxpayer identification numbers. Subsequently, these authors determined changes in physician group practice affiliation and calculated the sizes of any group-affiliated practices. So, the number of EM physicians in their database grew from 16,000 back in 2012 to 33,000 in 2020. The number of emergency practices stayed roughly stable from about 4,800 to 5,200. And so as you can probably do the math in your head, more physicians and the same number of groups means, yep, larger groups. The largest growth, however, considering the number of physicians involved, was in groups with sizes greater than 500 emergency physicians, in which the proportion of emergency physicians practicing grew from 15% to 24%. The growth here was primarily at the expense of physician groups sized 2 to 24, and likely fueled by new emergency physicians entering the workforce as well as expansion of these larger groups. How these changes should be viewed is probably beyond the scope of this little discussion. Larger organizations have economies of scale, and larger groups of physicians may have improved bargaining power at work. However, employee representation in setting the priorities of the group matters, as well as the approach to reimbursement from patient encounters and individual compensation. Regardless, this article simply tells us objectively what we already could kind of perceive on our own. Larger groups are dominating the staffing in U.S. emergency departments.
We're just small little cogs in very big wheels.
Yes. It just gets a big sigh from us. It doesn't really get a whole lot of insightful analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think it's hard, you know, you can't really say too much from this, but it doesn't look like a good thing. I think it's safe to say.
I mean, I think that's the idea. It's like, if you look at sort of the perspectives that, you know, a whole bunch of emergency physicians getting together could actually do a lot of good for their, you know, work environment versus, it depends on, you know, how the group is structured and who actually has the power in the group. So I think a large group by itself is not a bad thing. Because then you can negotiate with the hospitals and you can, there's a give and take and you know, bargaining power. That's like the basis of sort of like, you know, collective bargaining and unions and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, it depends on who actually owns the group. And it doesn't seem like the people who own the groups these days tend to have the physician's best interests at heart.
I think that's a fair statement. Though, can't really say that from the perspective of the paper. All right, well, why don't we move from the depressing to the frustrating? Our next article is fixed versus variable dosing of prothrombin complex concentrate for bleeding complications of vitamin K antagonists, the proper 3 randomized clinical trial. And the lead author is Raihat Abdulkalam. So anyone who's given 4-factor PCC for warfarin reversal knows it's a bit of a pain, and as the dosing is based both on the patient's weight and also their current INR. And while in the end, it's not like you have to do advanced calculus, it is something that you constantly have to look up because we tend to give it rather infrequently and it is a little tricky to do. Moreover, you have to wait for the INR to come back before you can administer the medication. So these authors thought to simplify the process by examining a fixed dose regimen of 1,000 international units to see if that was not inferior to the traditional more complex dosing regimen. They conducted an open-label, multi-center, randomized clinical trial for patients with non-intracranial bleeds requiring warfarin reversal with 4-factor PCC. The patients were randomized to either the fixed dose 1,000 units of 4-factor PCC or the traditional dosing strategy based on weight and INR. Over a 5-year period, they enrolled 199 patients. Of note, the attended sample size was 300, but the trial was stopped early for slow enrollment. And we'll talk about that a little more later and why that's important. Overall, 159 of these patients were included in the per protocol analysis. And essentially what happened is effective hemostasis was achieved in 87% of the fixed dose group and 89.9% of the traditional strategy. Median door to needle time was faster, not surprisingly, in the fixed dose group at 109 minutes versus 142 minutes, not surprisingly, because you didn't have to wait for the INR to come back to give the medication. And the amount of patients who had an INR less than 2 at 60 minutes was fairly similar between the two groups at 91.2% in the fixed group and 91.7% in the standard regime. So all in all, these groups appear fairly equivalent. Unfortunately, the authors were not able to demonstrate non-inferiority as the confidence surrounding the effect size of their primary outcome didn't actually cross the non-inferiority threshold. Now, this is probably because of two reasons. First, the lower than intended sample size created larger confidence intervals than what they had anticipated when deciding their non-inferiority threshold. And also, they powered the study with the assumption that the fixed dose group would be 4% superior to the previous traditional strategy, which I thought was kind of weird. And so both of these things are going to have a similar effect. If they had enrolled the intended amount of patients, the 300 patients, the confidence would have been smaller and less likely to cross the non-inferiority threshold. And if they had initially assumed that the two strategies would be more towards equivalent or the fixed dose strategy might be a little less efficacious, they would have realized that they needed more patients, thus again creating smaller confidence intervals and thus maybe not crossing the non-inferiority threshold. And so like what happens so often when we talk about non-inferiority trials is you end up with a situation where by all measurements, the two strategies appear fairly equivalent, but because of the way they powered the study, non-inferiority cannot be determined. It's disappointing.
Yes. I love non-inferiority trials. Oh, well, I don't know why they chose 4% as a superiority goal for this trial.
No, it made no sense.
If it was like
right?
a time-based thing and they thought that the fixed dose was going to be administered more quickly and there was a specific time to hemostatic or whatever it is, then maybe you could find an advantage to it. But there's no specific reason why that a weight-based dose would be less efficacious than a fixed dose specifically. In any event, I mean, I think I've been at centers doing fixed dose strategies for a really long time. I think Kaiser was doing fixed dose strategies rather than weight-based strategies. And I love how you're complaining about weight-based strategies. Well, we still give gentamicin down here, and we have to figure out the ideal body weight to do that. Not just body weight and INR.
Do you have to do that, or your pharmacist?
How tall? Oh, I have to do it. I have to look at you. How tall are you? What's your renal function? What's your gender? Figure out your actual ideal body weight, and then dose it based on indication. So it's not that big a deal to go dose this, but I agree that I think fixed dose is totally fine. I think a lot of places have been moving to fixed dose. One, because the fixed dose is typically lower, and it saves them some money. And it's just as good. I mean, there's no evidence that fixed dose is worse, even if the so-called non-inferiority margin is not met.
Right, exactly. And you get your INRs back so fast, you can give a second dose if you need to in the patients that you don't quite get under 2. So overall, it's probably just a more effective way of dosing it. Now, unfortunately, because of the way they powered their study and doing themselves.
It's the classic. It's not inferior, but it's also not inferior.
Yeah.
Ah, good times. All right. Moving right along. The next article that's in this issue that we'd like to highlight here is called Venous Thromboembolism in Patients Discharged from the Emergency Department with Ankle Fractures. Lead author here is Kirat Grewal, and they are at Sinai Health in Toronto. I think this is actually one worth listening to because I think it actually has a pretty decent chance of changing your local practice. Because when we talk about lower extremity venous thromboembolism, we know from our risk stratification tools and orthopedic experience the elevated risk for VTE in patients with surgical and immobilized lower extremities. We always see these patients on anticoagulation, and really the question most being investigated is what dose ought to be used for prophylaxis. But well, this is a retrospective analysis of a province-wide data set from Ontario, Canada, looking at the downstream incidence of VTE in patients discharged from the emergency room with ankle fracture diagnoses. And the answer, within 90 days, they found 1.3%. So the follow-up question is, how much of that incidence of VTE is attributable to the ankle fracture diagnosis itself, rather than the comorbidities of their population presenting with, you know, a median age of 49 years and an ankle fracture? Well, they do a propensity match on a subset of those patients, comparing them with patients who have diagnoses of fingers and wrist fractures. In their matched cohorts, the incidence of VTE with the ankle fractures was still 1.3 to 1.4%, while the incidence of VTE in those discharged from the emergency department with wrist and finger fractures was 0.2%. So I think that's a pretty decent relative and absolute risk increase associated with an ankle fracture. Within the group of those patients with VTE after an ankle fracture, the authors also looked to see if there were any specific demographic features for those at increased risk for VTE. For the most part, the features examined sort of hovered around unity, regardless of adjustments or not. Neither hypertension or age or cancer, etc., are reliable enough to influence subsequent VTE to make a difference. However, patients with a VTE or a superficial venous thrombosis diagnosis in the last 10 years were 5 times more likely than not to develop a VTE. So this is a pretty reasonable analytic approach and point estimate in my view, and it certainly makes me think a little harder about discharging ankle fracture without starting them on anticoagulation. Now, they don't break apart the ankle fracture diagnoses by type, and it's reasonable to say a distal fibula is a lower energy, lower tissue trauma injury than others, so there may yet be more heterogeneity to risk within the cohort evaluated. But at this point, I would very likely look at a patient with an eye towards any baseline elevated risks for VTE, particularly any prior VTE, and weigh that against short-term bleeding risks with a risk stratification tool to consider starting prophylactic oral anticoagulation in these patients. We have a disagreement.
Yeah, I just don't know if we're there yet. I mean, the risk is still fairly low, and so you're going to be anticoagulating a lot of people to prevent, you know, a few DVTs, and you're basing it off kind of this retrospective study. I certainly am more concerned than I was previously, but again, you don't know. Yeah, what kind of fractures are we talking here? Was it the fracture and the trauma itself, or is it the mobilization after? You know, are these fractures that have to be immobilized longer, or the ones that, you know, that you can wear a boot, or are those ones safer? I just think there's more information we need before we go into coagulating all these patients.
So you want the RCT?
I mean, ideally, we always want RCT, but this is going to be a tough one to RCT, right? 6 years from now, we can get that information. But what do we do tomorrow? I don't know. I still don't think I'm quite ready to anticoagulate all patients like I see with ankle fractures.
I'm not suggesting you start anticoagulating the 32-year-old with no risk factors, who's not on oral contraceptives, who's never had a VTE before, and has a distal fibula fracture, and you put it in a splint. I don't think that patient's going to benefit from anticoagulation. I'm talking about the 66-year-old who had a DVT 5 years ago, was on 3 months of anticoagulation for it, who is going to be 100% immobilized in there from their, you know, trimal or bimal or whatever it ends up being for 6 to 8 weeks. That's a different fracture. So I think it's one of those things where you I think these patients post-surgery, you know, right. in orthopedics, they get started on prophylactic anticoagulation. And just because you're not going to surgery, these patients are still obviously at elevated risk, and it's a heterogeneous risk. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's just, you know, something to think about. And if they are not at specifically high risk for bleeding, you know, again, you can risk stratify their bleeding again. You know, this is where the sort of like, you know, generalizing and extrapolating and thinking about whether it's appropriate or not comes into play. And you don't do it to everybody, but it's something to discuss and think about.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Using shocking. Your brain. Medicine can still, you can still use your brain outside of a you know, protocol, but
doctoring thing.
With the you know, respectful uncertainty that we don't know this is precisely the right thing to do, but we think it might be the best. And you can involve those patients in that, you know, uncertainty as far as the shared decision-making conversation. We do that all the time.
I think it's
too.
Interesting. I think I'm certainly going to think harder about it now. Which is unfortunate because, you know, these were fairly easy dispositions in the past. All right. Why don't we move on?
All right.
Our next article is an interesting one. The use of adhesive tape to facilitate optimal mask positioning and use in the emergency department, a randomized control trial. The lead author is Nicholas Petit. It's safe to say that a mask worn across the nose and mouth is more effective than a mask worn under the chin or below the nose or any of the many other various ways we see patients sporting them throughout the emergency department. So these authors wanted to see if taping the mask to one's face improves the rate of proper usage. They conducted an open-label, single-center, randomized controlled trial, and they enrolled all patients presenting to the ED for evaluation. The patients were permitted to wear their own cloth mask or a surgical mask that was given to them at the emergency department. Patients were randomized to have a piece of surgical tape over the bridge of their nose, or they were allowed to wear their mask as they saw fit. The authors enrolled 123 patients. 60 minutes after randomization, 100% of the patient in the intervention group versus only 69 of the people in the control group had correct mask placement. In the control group, the patients who were not wearing their mask correctly commonly had their nose exposed, or they were wearing their mask under their chin, or they were exposing both their nose and their mouth. There were no apparent complications caused by the surgical tape itself.
Tape to the nose. No, you know,
maybe they didn't stay till they had to rip the tape off, which at times can be painful. You know, so this is a kind of interesting, kind of funny, single small center study that, you know, says something that's not very surprising. If you tape a mask to someone's face, they're more likely to have that mask in place 60 minutes later when you come and check on them. The question is, how clinically relevant is this benefit? You know, you can go into how long does the tape actually last? How often do you have to reapply the tape? You know, is it really worth it? I don't know, but I guess if you really want people to wear their mask better, taping it to their face is an option.
Yes, we need to start discussing the number needed to tape to prevent one downstream SARS-CoV-2 transmission event. And then also, which variant are we talking about? What's the local prevalence? taping things to people makes them stay in place. But yes.
I mean, it's not surprising. Like, emergency physicians have been taping stuff to people. Speaking of it, since 50 years ago, when this journal first came out, we used tape for everything.
I mean, you tape people's IV cannulas in place, you know. I mean, you put a little tegaderm and it's taped down, you know, like same sort of thing. You tape things to people, they don't move around. Yes, again, the question being how clinically helpful is this actually as far as, you know, preventing the spread of SARS-CoV-2 in your emergency department? And right now, probably not that great. Oh, well. Well, all right, moving along. One more article from this issue we'll highlight. It's called Oral Ondansetron Administration in Children Seeking Emergency Department Care for Acute Gastroenteritis, a Patient-Level Propensity Matched Analysis. And the lead author here is Elizabeth Powell, and they are at Northwestern University. So, wow, an ondansetron and pediatric gastroenteritis paper. We have seen a lot of these papers in our lifetime. Observational series, randomized trials, and all manner of outcomes and concerns. Some
it's not surprising they could make a meta-analysis of
with,
them.
With some implying reduced intravenous hydration rates, while others finding no difference, and yet others concerned the ondansetron might otherwise mask a serious underlying illness. This is a prospective observational study out of the PCARN and PERC networks and part of the PROGUT probiotic trial for outpatient gastroenteritis. And we would be remiss, of course, if we didn't mention the outcome of the PROGUT trial, which tried to use one of two probiotic preparations to try and stave off the development of moderate gastroenteritis, and was a neutral result. The probiotics did not help. But anyways, within the trial, clinicians were allowed to treat patients with oral ondansetron upon arrival at the index visit at their own discretion. The trial then tracked those patients who subsequently required intravenous fluids and or hospitalization within 72 hours or change in the frequency of vomiting and diarrhea within the first 24 hours after the study visit. There were 794 patients in this trial who met their criteria as being eligible for the physician discretion oral ondansetron, approximately half of whom received ondansetron and half who did not. Generally speaking, there were small differences between those who received oral ondansetron and those who did not. Those who received ondansetron tended to have a few more episodes of diarrhea and vomiting before arrival and were a little bit older. So the authors created this propensity match to attempt to balance the two groups for another analysis. The official winner, just kind of like our non-inferiority trial, you know, is no one because so many of the confidence intervals for the binary outcomes cross unity. However, the real winner is probably oral ondansetron. The authors, hewing to the straight and narrow, cite only the statistically significant outcome, which, in this study, is the proportion of patients receiving intravenous fluids at the index visit in their propensity-based analysis. 7% with ondansetron and 14% without. However, across the board, pretty much every other outcome is at least no worse or better with oral ondansetron, even hospitalization at the index visit or within 72 hours. So, not a randomized controlled trial. Doesn't really add that much clarity or novelty to the huge body of work that already exists for pediatric gastroenteritis. Doesn't really trim down the specific patient population for whom oral ondansetron might be most beneficial. But ondansetron at this point is pretty inexpensive and has virtually no downside. And it may actually help. So, you know, count me into the sort of, it's probably fine to give oral ondansetron and it may actually help. Camp.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't really know what to make of these results. Like you said, we have reasonably good randomized control trial data at this point. And so how this adds to the data and how your post-test probability of benefit changes with this, I'm not really sure. You know, it's funny that most of our randomized control trial data shows ondansetron works about as good as normal saline and slightly less good than alcohol wipes. So I'm not surprised by the results they found. But like you said, it's rather cheap. It's essentially harmless. Maybe it has a little bit of benefit.
Yeah, then I mean, if for a medication again, it's cheap and harmless. Even if the outcomes aren't terribly profound, like you know, needing intravenous fluids or an index hospitalization, yeah, those are decent outcomes. Some of them, even if the number treats 1 in 100 or 1 in 200, for something that's inexpensive, it's still more expensive to admit somebody to the hospital. So, you know. It's certainly not doing any harm. If you're giving oral ondansetron to children right now,
you're a monster.
Don't feel bad about it. You're not a monster. And maybe even someday there might be actual clarity into some specific subgroup of patients for whom this has the greatest benefit and for which ones it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Someday, I just don't see the value in really exploring this much further.
Certainly not without
bigger questions and better questions to be asked.
Yeah, and study designs that possibly at this point could kind of add to this data. All right. Well, I think that wraps us up for another month. Again, like I said earlier, this was Ryan and I's 6-year anniversary of doing the podcast. So, you know, we've been doing this for 6 years. It started out with us saying we're not fired yet every month. Then that went to every 6 months. Then it goes to about once a year when we talk about that we've been here for 1 year longer. Speaking for myself, I'm overjoyed to still be doing this. Very honored that I'm still able to speak with everybody every month and kind of discuss what's going on in the annals and in emergency medicine.
And your feedback is very important to us. We've stopped talking about the weather so much, but if you have any other constructive feedback, we'd love to hear it. I believe annalsaudio@asep.org is our feedback address, and we're happy to hear and happy to change and evolve with the times.
Yeah, and hopefully we have a better 2022.
We could even do a TikTok. Do you think we could do a TikTok? Annals of Emergency Medicine TikTok.
Starting in 2022.
I do have a face for radio, though.
You do indeed. All right. On that note, I think that wraps us up for another month. This was Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this was the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast. So long.